This is the Citizen of Heaven podcast number 232, Whining. I am Hal Hammonds, Citizen of Heaven, your embedded correspondent in Satan's world. Thanks for listening, rating, and subscribing. This week's episode is for all the football fans out there. If you're a friend and you think I'm talking about you, you're probably right. Today we will discuss the kind of children who don't whine and why you should be one, a pair of mice and what they can teach us about the maze of life, the extreme unlikelihood of college football referees actually being bought and paid for, and how pitching a hissy fit can help you conquer the world. We'll start with what I've been preaching. The language of Philippians 2:14 seems pretty transparent. In the CSB it reads, "Do everything without grumbling and arguing." You don't need a 5-minute exegesis or a lecture in Greek to understand that. Since we still have complainers in the church, all of whom presumably have heard Philippians 2:14 and decided it doesn't pertain to them, let's dig a little deeper in the context and see why complaining is so contrary to the nature of the Christian. Let's start by finishing the sentence. Paul goes on to write in verses 15 and 16, "So that you may be blameless and pure, children of God, who are faultless in a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine like stars in the world by holding firm to the word of life." The world is full of complainers. Your job as a Christian is to stand apart from the world, especially in this context, by avoiding grumbling and arguing. The word of life calls us to a nobler existence than that. And you can look at the word of life here as being the gospel that calls us out of the world, Romans 8:30. Or you can capitalize the W and talk about Jesus himself. He is the living word, according to John 1:1. Holding to Jesus means holding to his character, his example. More on that in a moment. We are children of God, Paul writes. As such, we should take on his image. Growing up to be like your dad in the flesh may be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on your dad. True children of Abraham act like Abraham acted, Jesus says in John 8:39 and 40. And true children of God act like God acts. That said, when did God ever whine? When does God act as though his own personal inconvenience or discomfort was ever the most important consideration? Surely the sending of Jesus to the cross settled that issue once and for all. The description of the suffering servant in Isaiah 53 reaches an emotional climax in verse 10. "Yet the Lord was pleased to crush him severely." It pleased him. Of course, that does not mean that the father took a perverse, twisted satisfaction in watching his son hang on the cross. It means God accepted the cross as a necessary part of the salvation process and made the sacrifice that had to be made. Surely the child of God who sees God's plan at work in his life, who sees heaven itself on the horizon, will not fuss about some small hardships along the way. I said we'd come back to Jesus. Back up to verse 5. "Adopt the same attitude as that of Christ Jesus." This is a follow-up to Paul's admonition in verse 3. "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility consider others as more important than yourselves." Doesn't that strike right at the heart of complaining? If someone else is advanced in life instead of you, your instinct is to become resentful. "Why not me?" you may ask yourself. You may ask a few friends, too, if you think they'll be sympathetic. And suddenly you're a complainer. But Jesus wasn't like that. As we read in verse 8, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even to death on the cross. When did Jesus ever whine? Yes, occasionally he pointed out the injustice and hypocrisy of the ones who were oppressing him. But as a rule, he didn't even do that. Again in Isaiah 53, this time verse 7. "He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb led to the slaughter, and like a sheep before her shearers, he did not open his mouth." Jesus embraced far more ill treatment than you will ever face. If you want to be an imitator of Jesus, you can't fuss every time you're asked to go through a small sampling of the injustice and indignity he had to face. We bypassed verses 12 and 13. I want to spend a minute there before we move on. "Therefore, my dear friends, just as you have always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, but even more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who is working in you, both to will and to work, according to his good purpose." God worked out Jesus' ultimate exaltation by taking him to the cross. And he is currently working out your exaltation. But he will not always take you in the direction you expected, or that you would have chosen for yourself. If you have faith, you will accept his plan and do the things he gives you to do, and without complaining about it. His commandments are not burdensome, we read in 1 John 5:3. If you persist in that pattern of behavior, if you continue to walk by faith, it becomes more than simple compliance. Paul says God is working in us to work, yes, but also to will. If it is truly your fondest desire to be found faithful in Jesus, if you pursue salvation in God's designated pathways, you'll realize more and more that it's not just your responsibility to submit. It's your privilege and your pleasure. And with that kind of attitude, what's there to complain about? This is what I've been reading. I'm committed to keeping my per-book cost below $4, so the clearance rack is my home away from home. But Who Moved My Cheese by Dr. Spencer Johnson was just 100 pages or so, and they were small pages. So instead of spending $3, I just read it right there in the store. Hal Hammond's famous tightwad. Never saw a penny I couldn't pinch. In hindsight, I kind of wish I'd bought it anyway. Who Moved My Cheese is an outstanding book. A parable of sorts, describing how people respond to changing environments. Johnson tells the story of Scurry and Scruffy, two mice who run a maze every day to get their cheese. With them in the maze are Him and Haw, two little people, essentially mouse-sized humans. When the cheese at the expected location runs out, Scurry and Scruffy go back into the maze and eventually find another station with far more cheese than they'd ever seen. Him and Haw, though, persist in going back to the previous location. They preferred to whine about their situation than expend extra energy in search of a better one. Eventually, Haw worked up the gumption to venture out like the mice did, and he found the same wonderful landing spot they found. Him never made it. Johnson's point is that circumstances naturally and inevitably change in life. The rewards you come to expect at the end of a certain pattern of behavior are rarely permanent. Things change, and usually for the worse. Settling for the status quo in such circumstances is not just unsatisfactory. It may even be dangerous. As Dr. Horrible famously opined, the status is not quo. If you don't catch the reference, do a YouTube search for Dr. Horrible. You can thank me later. Humans send mice scurrying through mazes and labs all over the place so the mice can learn. But really, we're trying to teach ourselves. The fictitious experiment in the book is supposed to teach the importance of adaptation. If you want something out of life, money, love, popularity, whatever, you're going to have to work for it. And if you're blessed enough to achieve it, you're going to have to work to keep it. You can blame the system if you want, but it won't put more cheese on your plate. I think God is playing the part of the scientist in this story, and we are Him and Haw. The ever-changing system of successes and failures is intended to bring out the best in you. God is making you exercise. He's challenging your thinking processes. It's not because he takes some strange pleasure in yanking the rug out from under you, any more than a scientist is moving the cheese because he secretly hates mice. He's teaching you something, and you may never fully understand what that something is. That's why he gives you the cheese. You come to see God as the giver of every good gift, James 1:17, and you learn to delight in your blessed circumstances. You count yourself privileged to run wherever he wants you to run. Why wouldn't you? You love cheese, right? But there's an option. You can hem and haw instead of scurrying. You can blame God for what seems in your mouse-like mind to be inconsistent and counterproductive actions. You can stage a sit-in where you want to be and expect God to change his mind. Jonah tried that on the outskirts of Nineveh after God chose not to destroy them like he was supposed to. How dare he be all gracious and merciful like that? Maybe you're stalled in your life right now. Your job is unsatisfying. Your marriage is stagnant. Your brethren are self-involved. Your children are increasingly rebellious. You haven't changed. The world has changed, and you're not happy about it. Hey, I'm not either. Nobody really likes change. We sometimes say we do when it's the change we choose for ourselves. But change apart from our own control is terrible. It's also inevitable. So quit complaining. Learn to see new challenges as new opportunities, with new blessings from God waiting on the other side. Trust in God to put your cheese in the best possible place, and then make your best effort to find it. This is what I've been hearing. There's a great scene in the film Citizen Kane in which Charles Foster Kane, a newspaper mogul, is running for governor of New York. On election night, his staff stands hovering over the front page that reads, "Kane elected." "We have no choice," one says, and they go with the alternative headline that's been prepared, "Fraud at polls." I think a lot of sports fans look at the final score of their team's big game that way. Either "we won" or "we was robbed." That's why they put referees in striped shirts, the old joke goes. They're criminals, all of them. Well, not all of them, just the ones that make the wrong calls. And by wrong calls, we mean the ones that didn't go our way. I will comment verbally about the officials during the game from time to time, I'll admit. I would say it's all done quietly. Feel free to ask my neighbors what they think about it the next time you're in the area. I would also say I'm as likely to comment on what looks like a good call, even a good call that goes against my team. Frankly, I don't know how they do it as well as they do. I think the biggest takeaway from the advent of instant replay is how often the officials make a good call in a split second that can't be improved on with hours and hours of investigation from multiple vantage points. Sometimes, though, they get it wrong, or at least they appear to. And the more I think about why calls go wrong, the less inclined I am to complain about them. Some so-called bad calls are just judgment calls, pure and simple. Some rules in sports, football in particular, are vague by their nature. Officials receive hours and hours of training and plenty of experience officiating at lower levels of competition before appearing on your TV screen. It's reasonable to assume their judgment is pretty good. It's also reasonable to assume that the fan wearing the other team's colors would be just as upset as you are now had the same call gone the other way. The same goes for missed calls. Six or seven officials are watching 22 players for examples of dozens of possible infractions. Things go undetected on many or most plays. And again, I think it's reasonable to assume missed calls more or less balance one another out. And yes, occasionally a penalty call is just plain wrong. It may come at a critical moment. It may even seem to directly affect the outcome, or your wager if you have money on the game, but we'll cover gambling another time. I would even go so far as to say borderline calls tend to go the way of the home team a bit more than 50% of the time. That's unfortunate, unless you're the home team, of course. But it's hardly a criminal offense. Imagine doing your job, whatever it is, with a few million people watching you, each of them with a personal interest in your work, some of whom appear more than capable and more than willing to do you bodily harm if you're found lacking. People make mistakes. Move on. I'm aware that the whole "it's just a game" argument is immediately accepted by practically everyone, and then immediately forgotten the next time the refs mess up. But bear with me and let me make it one more time. Hebrews 10 verses 32 through 36 reads, quote, "Remember the earlier days, when, after you had been enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to taunts and afflictions, and at other times you were companions of those who were treated that way. For you sympathized with the prisoners, and accepted with joy the confiscation of your possessions, because you know that you yourselves have a better and enduring possession. So don't throw away your confidence, which has a great reward, for you need endurance, so that after you've done God's will, you may receive what was promised." End quote. Some early Christians were experiencing genuine unfairness. They were suffering in real and profound ways. The writer urges them to remember their calling. Jesus will see his people through in times of adversity. The faithful will be vindicated eventually. And even if it's not within their own lifetimes, it should be enough to know that they were on the side of right, and their judge saw that even if no one else did. Such ones are blessed in the eyes of God and have no reason to complain in this life. Remember that the next time the yellow flag either does or does not fly. This is what I've been playing. When gamers refer to player interaction, usually they mean one player attacking another player. It's part of the game, and to many gamers, it's why they play games in the first place. In theory, everyone has a good time, win or lose, and they leave the table as friends. In theory. Risk is likely the game best known for player interactivity. 2 to 6 players compete to see which of them will be the ruler of the world. Players will get attacked. There's no getting around that. The trick, especially with a large number of players, is to hole up in a corner of the map, preferably Eastern Australia, and mind your own business for as long as possible. Gradually, you build up your forces, and eventually you go all out to conquer one of your opponents, and ideally, eliminate him or her from the game. There are two versions of this strategy. Attack the big guy, and attack the little guy. You attack the big guy, the strongest army on the map, if you want the game to last for an extra 2 hours, and or if you want to lose. I will all but guarantee both of these results for those who choose the attack the big guy strategy. Attacking the weakest player is much more likely to succeed in the short term, and it may springboard you to more and bigger successes down the line. The problem is, eliminating the weakest player means he has to sit around doing nothing while everyone else plays the game. Risk players would say, that's what happens in Risk. He knew that coming in. If he doesn't like that, he should have played better, or else stayed home and done a jigsaw puzzle. I say that's one of the reasons I don't play Risk anymore, but to each his own. There's a bigger problem with the little guy strategy, though, and if you followed the gist of the episode to this point, you're probably ahead of me. Frequently, though not always, the little guy turns out to be a whiner. Why are you picking on me? I'm not in your way. He's the one who killed 15 of your armies in Iceland. Pick on him. The whiner is the reason why efforts to completely eliminate a player from the game must be successful. If he survives your attack, every other player knows he'll just whine some more if he gets attacked again. They may decide to be merciful to him instead and save everyone the waterworks. Then, lo and behold, 4 hours later, the whiner's actually won the game. Bad behavior has been rewarded. The whiner's certain to repeat his crimes in the next game. Of course, it won't work with the same crew. They'll probably agree ahead of time to attack no one but the whiner until he's out of the game, just to teach him a lesson. But the time to teach the lesson has passed, and everyone, including the whiner, is the worse for it. And here's the lesson that needs to be taught. Life is hard. You will get punched in the face. And yes, sometimes it's personal. But most of the time, it's just a matter of playing the game of life. The actual game of life, that is, not the board game, which I covered in episode 148. Job's friend Eliphaz wasn't right about everything, but he was right about that. Man is born for trouble as sparks fly upward, Job 5:7. If life were comfortable all the time, we wouldn't long for heaven like we should. Remember 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1 through 5, quote, "For if we know that our earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal dwelling in the heavens, not made with hands. Indeed, we groan in this tent, desiring to put on our heavenly dwelling, since when we have taken it off, we will not be found naked. Indeed, we groan while we're in this tent, burdened as we are, because we do not want to be unclothed, but clothed, so that mortality may be swallowed up by life. Now, the one who prepared us for this very purpose is God, who gave us the Spirit as a down payment." End quote. Yes, life here is painful. Yes, people will beat on us from time to time. And yes, we'll feel like whining to God about it. And God will listen. Psalm 142:2 reads, "I pour out my complaint before him. I reveal my trouble to him." But don't imagine that the solution is for God to change things to make your problems go away. He may do that. But then again, he may not. The more important result of prayer is that you remind yourself who the real ruler of the world is. The one who truly cares about your condition, and who will ultimately bring a better solution than you ever could acquire for yourself. Thank you for listening to the Citizen of Heaven podcast. Please rate, review, and share so others can access this content. I encourage you also to join the Heaven Citizens Facebook group. There you will find links to related materials, conversation starters, poll questions, and the occasional special announcement. Also, check out the Hal Hammonds channel on YouTube for even more content. Until next time, be strong and courageous, fight the good fight of faith, and do all things in the name of the Lord Jesus. This is Hal Hammonds, Citizen of Heaven, signing off.